Proceed to the next case of the day. Deborah McKenzie against Michael Astrew, appeal number 10-2654. Mr. Schultz.
May it please the Court, Your Honors. Barry Schultz on behalf of plaintiff Deborah McKenzie. In the Social Security disability procedures, administrative law judges may at times rely on the medical vocational guidelines, also known as the GRIDs, to find that a claimant is not disabled. But they can only do so if a claimant suffers from solely exertional limitations, which are what they call the strength requirements, lifting, carrying, sitting, standing. If a claimant suffers from non-exertional limitations, then the GRID does not apply to dictate a finding that a claimant is not disabled. And this Court has held in the Luna case, which was cited by the Commissioner, that, quote, in cases where a non-exertional limitation might substantially reduce a range of work an individual can perform, the ALJ must consult a vocational expert. Now, in this case, while there was a vocational expert at the hearing, and the ALJ asked one hypothetical question of, she did not rely on his testimony in her decision, but relied solely on the medical vocational guidelines. We contend that that was error, because Ms. McKenzie suffered from significant non-exertional limitations, which takes the case off of the GRIDs, as this court noted in the DeFrancesco versus Bowen case, requiring the ALJ to actually consult with the vocational expert on the specific limitations. The ALJ found that Ms. McKenzie suffered or required frequent accommodations due to her visual problems. She doesn't explain that limitation, but based on the testimony of Ms. McKenzie, she had fluctuating vision throughout the day. Her treating optometrist and ophthalmologist provided evidence that the clarity of her vision fluctuated throughout the day and that she could not focus on objects up close for prolonged periods of time. In the discussion during the hearing, the vocational expert actually described his understanding of problems with visual accommodation, indicating that a person with such a problem has trouble changing focus from looking at something close to looking at something more in the distance, and they would have blurred vision in making that change. And so plaintiff argues or asserts that a person suffering from visual limitations like that, that takes them off of the medical vocational guidelines. The ALJ in this case only found that the non-exertional limitations would not significantly limit the range of light work that Ms. McKenzie could perform. She provided no explanation for that, and there's no evidence in the record that supports her finding. The district court affirmed the ALJ on this point, but in doing so, he found that fluctuating vision, quote, merely requires an accommodation, such as extra time from work, in order to compensate for the slow adjustment in focus, close quotes. But we believe that actually supports plaintiff's claim, because if a person is going to require extra time to perform their job, they may not be able to sustain employment. And that's something that a vocational expert should have been required to consider in reaching their conclusions.
Mr. Schultz, a lot of times we'll see vocational expert testimony that will say the claimant can do light assembly work or office work or something of that sort. We didn't have anything like that in this record that I saw, but maybe I'm overlooking something, wasn't it?
Well, in this case,
the reason I'm asking is because I'm trying to understand the effects of this requirement for frequent accommodation for vision problems.
Right. Well, in this case, the ALJ did question the vocational expert, but the hypothetical question that was asked included a limitation to occasionally using the hands, limitation to light work, only moderate exposure to hazards, and then the need for frequent accommodations due to the visual problems. In response to that hypothetical question, the vocational expert said there were no jobs that the claimant could perform
with the occasional use of the hands.
Well, that was the focus.
Yeah.
That's correct. But then after that testimony, the ALJ said, well, I guess that's it then, and ended the hearing, didn't ask any further questions. So whether the frequent use of the hands with the frequent accommodation problems allowed for significant numbers of jobs, the vocational expert never provided an opinion on that issue. And we believe that the law required that. The Social Security ruling 8314 is particularly instructive because it talks about, for light work, that there are some limitations, and the examples they give are climbing poles or climbing scaffolding, or the inability to feel extremes of temperature or an allergy to feathers. Those kinds of limitations won't impact the ability to perform light work. But that other problems, like visual problems that might make a person hazardous in the workplace, because if they can't see things on the ground due to peripheral vision problems, that would have a significant impact on light work. The ruling also says that light work requires grasping for holding and turning objects. And that if there's any limitation, that's what the ruling says, any limitation in that area, that the ALJ must carefully consider the impact on the ability to perform light work. Well, even in the ALJ's own decision, she limited Ms. McKinsey to frequently using the hands, which means she can use them for up to two-thirds of the workday. But it also means that she can't use her hands for grasping for one-third of the workday. And how that would impact the ability to perform light work, which could include working an assembly line or being a packer, as a cashier, food preparation. Again, there's no evidence in this record that it would not have a significant impact. And the ruling says that where you fall between extremes, that a vocational resource such as a vocational expert should be inquired of, and again, that was not done here on these issues.
What was the primary physician's opinion, I guess, on the use of hands?
Well, there is not one primary physician in this case, so I can't really respond. There were numerous.
Did a primary physician say he didn't have really much of a problem?
Yes, one orthopedic surgeon, Dr. Podubsky, on one date in August of 2005 said that he didn't think she had any limitations. The ALJ rejected that opinion because the ALJ found that there were limitations in use of the hands, contrary to Dr. Podubsky's opinion, which was that there were no limitations. But prior to that, there were several physicians that opined that there were significant limitations in using the hands, including the treating neurosurgeon, Dr. Uden, treating physical therapist, the consultative examiner provided a detailed report. And that brings me to the next primary argument, which is that the ALJ failed to consider and discuss the opinion of the state agency doctors, because two state agency doctors opined that Ms. McKinsey could only use her hands occasionally for grasping gross and fine manipulation. The ALJ doesn't mention that opinion in her decision. And the regulation, 20 CFR 404-1527F, and the ruling, SSR 96-6P, mandate, they say the ALJ must discuss the opinions of state agency physicians and must explain in their decisions the weight given to those opinions. Whereas in this case, the ALJ doesn't even mention the opinion other than to say that the state agency doctor said Ms. McKinsey could perform light work without recognizing this additional very significant limitation. And we know the limitation to occasional use of the hands is significant because the vocational expert said, based on that limitation, there were no jobs that Ms. McKinsey could perform.
Frankly, this case sort of seems upside down in that usually it's the claimant objecting to the reliance on the state agency doctors who've never seen them and who've said they're able to go build bridges and leap tall buildings in a single bound. And it's the treating physician who says, no, the person's in terrible shape and can't work. Here we've got it reversed.
A little right? bit.
Dr. Pardusky, as Judge Mannion was asking you about.
That's correct, a little bit. But that's why we think it's, for one thing, because so many claimants are found not disabled based on the opinions of the state agency physicians, where you have a case where the state agency physicians, who the commissioner recognizes as experts, actually provides a favorable opinion to the claimant, the ruling and regulation that I just cited mandates that the ALJ consider those opinions. And since claimants are denied benefits based on those opinions, when the opinion is favorable, we believe that the claimant should be at least given the benefit of what the regulation mandates for the ALJ to address the opinion. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Schultz. For the commissioner, Ms. Cohn.
Good Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Carol Cohn for the Commissioner of Social Security. As a preliminary matter, this case covers a long period of time from basically 2001 when Ms. McKenzie said she suffered an injury. She kept working. She filed in 2004 alleging a disability onset date in 2003, and it goes all the way into 2008. She alleges a great number of impairments, some of which came on later, some of which predated, and so forth. And I think it's important to look at the timeline with regard to the issues involved in this case. There were three doctors who recommended that she have surgery and thought that her cubital tunnel syndrome was significant enough. That was Dr. Von Gillern at the beginning, Dr. Udun, the neurological surgeon, and Dr. Pardubsky when he first saw her. Apparently, her condition changed because while nerve conduction studies in the earlier period were positive and therefore gave credence to her complaints along with some clinical findings. After 2003, she had a ton of them because her family doctor kept ordering them, and they were all negative. Now, that doesn't say she doesn't have a problem, but it's important to realize that she complained about this problem more or less at the same level from 2001 on. She got a workers' compensation settlement on it, but by the time she saw Dr. Pardubsky in, I believe it's August 2005, he said, the examination is almost completely benign, the nerve conduction is normal, no limits. Okay. The state agency physician opinion was a few months earlier, and of course, as we all know, state agency physicians don't examine. So he's relying on older records and the records of a consultant, Dr. Moody, and so forth. So the ALJ, I mean, counsel has said, but the ALJ didn't adopt Dr. Pardubsky's view that she had no limitations on her use of the hands. That's correct, but she's got a long time period, and she may have decided to give her the benefit of the doubt in terms of...
Don't you have a problem here on this issue, though, with, in essence, providing the explanation of what the ALJ should have thought or should have said to deal with this opinion? So we really have very, very little to go on from the opinion.
Are you referring with Dr. Pardubsky or the state agency?
Dr. Vincent, the state agency evaluation. And even, I mean, you've made the harmless error argument based on the next paragraph, which talks about the chiropractor's opinion.
Right.
But even those explanations don't get into what you're suggesting now, which is different time periods.
Well, the ALJ does discuss time periods in the sense that she notes that she worked at a light level up through her onset date, even though she described the same symptoms. She notes activities including going to school, which indicate that even with the condition as it was at that period of time, she chooses the position of Dr. Pardubsky, but by not adopting it in full, seems to indicate that she's aware that earlier, I mean, she discusses the evidence in detail, and the evidence shows the positive studies, the requests for surgery. In fact, as you know, she discusses the issue about having surgery. So she's aware of that. But the point is that while the articulation clearly could have been better in reference to the state agency doctor or the timeline or so forth, there's nothing that's going to be accomplished by remanding it just to explain how I came to this conclusion because it's all there. I mean, the condition did change. The later doctor did say what he said. And yet you have a claimant who goes on talking as if there are a lot of inconsistencies in what she told doctors and what she said at the hearing. And
Could you address the vision issue here? So frankly, that's my biggest concern. I don't know what it means to say that the claimant would need frequent accommodation for vision problems. I don't know what that means in terms of what she can actually still do.
Okay. The record shows, I just want to put it in context a little bit. The record does not show that she had a worsening vision problem over time. The record shows that way back before even 2001, she had surgery to correct nearsightedness. The record shows that she, in about 2003, had LASIK surgery, et cetera. There was an issue about, she thought something had gone wrong in that surgery.
She had about six or seven surgeries.
Yeah, some of them are cosmetic that relate to the eyelids and so forth. She corrected to 20/20. That's in the record and it's in my brief. Okay. In 2008, an ophthalmologist and an optometrist say that she has some difficulty changing her focus. Okay. When she had the LASIK surgery, she was given monovision, which means one eye is made to go so that it sees distance, and one eye is for near. And in a normal case, that works out, and the brain takes care of it, and the person can see both near and far. There's nothing in the record of from eye doctors that says that was radically wrong. There's certainly no evidence that the woman was bumping into things or couldn't. I mean, she was working through most of this. She was going to school, albeit she claimed she had some difficulty with seeing some things and so forth. But the record just clearly does not indicate that the woman was in any sense had a massive difficulty in seeing, and in fact, at the hearing, there was a discussion when she described difficulty changing focus, and she was describing her dry eye syndrome. The ALJ said that might be like when my eyes are dry and my contact lenses are sticky, like it takes a little longer to come into focus. But
she drove to the hearing.
She drove to the hearing. So, frankly, if you say what is frequent accommodations, it appears to be just that frequently there's a little lag time, but nothing based on her activities that would preclude work or significantly diminish the range of work. With regard to the use of the medical vocational guidelines, I'd just like to make clear, because Mr. Schultz said at the beginning, well, if you just have exertional limitations, then you can use the grid, but otherwise you need a VE. And then he started talking about some of the rulings which indicate there are certain circumstances in which you might need a VE and you might not. And that's, it's like, if non-exertional limitations are minor or not extremely significant, you don't need a VE. In other circumstances, you may, and that's the ALJ's choice. I see my time is out. If you have any okay.
It's not red yet. So.
That's not red?
No.
I guess I have a vision
problem. Many of us have some vision issues here. But okay, thank you very much, Ms. Conner.
It's almost red.
It's, yeah. It,
oh, okay. Yeah,
it's coming up. There you go.
There you go.
Ah!
Okay. All right, thank you. Rebuttal, Mr. Schultz.
You know, I'd just like to point out pages 845 through 848 of the record and page 790 are where the eye doctors indicate that the claimant has fluctuating visual acuity throughout the day. Page 847, the doctor indicated that it makes it difficult for her to sustain clear focus at near objects. While the commissioner's, Ms. Cohn, gave her opinion or her assessment of what the ALJ meant by frequent accommodations, the ALJ doesn't explain that in her decision. That should be something the ALJ should have to explain for this court to know whether or not it would significantly impact the ability to perform work. And based on what Ms. Cohn stated at the beginning of her argument in terms of the timeline, but my question then would be, well, since Dr. Podubsky didn't find until August of 2005 that at that point the claimant had no problems using her hands, why didn't the ALJ find her disabled from February 2003, her alleged onset date, until August of 2005, since up till that point you had significant number of opinions and evidence from doctors that there were significant limitations in using the hands. The neurosurgeon found atrophy in the hands and weakness. That would be one question that we have.
Thank you, Schultz. The case is taken under advisement. We'll proceed.